aisle where the heart-shaped boxes of chocolate are, reading labels. Another man is in the card aisle. Another man twirls all the false roses one by one, indecisively. Every time I buy detergent, I think about the oceans filling with soap and all the fish dying. I know it's not accurate, but isn't it true that all the water we have here on Earth is all the water we are ever going to have? For dinner, I make lamb chops seasoned with rosemary. I read that it's the herb of remembrance. So I put it on the lamb and I put it in the mashed potatoes. But it's too much rosemary and it's really not good. What I will remember, I realize, is this failure. February 16th. The chemistry teacher is on week two of his vacation, so we'll meet in last week's classroom. I suggest tennis before class with a foolproof provocation. I bet I can whoop ya, I say.
You bet wrong,
Dad says on cue. And of course he can. He used to do push-ups with me on his back. But this is not the point. The point is that the car is safe, in a spot where Levin won't be looking. I'm desperate to win, though. Rematch, I say, for the fourth or fifth time. He beats me swiftly again and again. As we're approaching the car in the parking lot, I can see a little rectangle of paper. A ticket. I whisk it off, hoping to do it fast enough that Dad won't notice, but he does.
What's that?
He asks. Menu, I say. February 19th.
Today you asked where babies came from, and I told you that they came from the mall. Where in the mall, you asked, and I told you the Burlington Coat Factory. I told you they were very expensive. I told you they were more expensive than the most expensive coat. We made a game of trying to find the most expensive coat.
I remember the look my mother gave him. It was a look that said, "Are you sure this is a good idea?"
"She won't remember this, Annie,"
he said. And I thought, "Remember this. You'll show them." February 20th. Today, Dad revives the topic of Joel. He knows that Joel isn't my fiancé anymore, except when he doesn't. The last trip Joel and I took together was to the beach. He was obsessed with the weather. He'd looked up the UV rating. It was unusually high and bound to give us very bad sunburns so long as we kept not discussing what needed discussing. All that had gone stagnant between us. We'd driven to Half Moon Bay for a picnic. We were eating sandwiches in silence. I like to think each of us was acting out of consideration for the other, knowing we lacked the satisfactory answers, choosing to spare each other the trouble by not asking the questions. Over by the water, there was a single black braid about to be pulled in of great interest to the gulls. What I can't figure out is if this thing is specific to me. With some frequency, I'll find artificial hair in public. Instead of coins, it's hair that appears, mainly on sidewalks and streets, improbably often. Together with Joel, there on this beach, was this not uncommon dreadlock. Dread, I said and pointed. In a week, it was over. All our years. That was the end of them. There was one last thing, I guess. A pelican staggering like a drunk, circling a baby who was laughing in the sand. You know, in Japanese, Joel said, the word for beak, kuchibashi, means mouth chopsticks. Those are more like mouth ladles, aren't they? Was what I said. Later, while he was asleep in the car and I was driving home, I couldn't stop crying. I'm over it, swear to God. But sometimes a thing washes up out of nowhere, like an ancient candlestick from some wrecked ship. Like that time I had appendicitis and after the operation was lying miserably in bed. Joel pulled out a deck of hotel cards to pass the time. We played Go Fish. We played hearts. He held my hand in one of his and with the other started to build a house from the cards.
He laid the foundation on my stomach, and I tried my best not to breathe. I tried to hold very still so I wouldn't be the one to bring it down.
"When you know you've found the one," my father is saying now, "you know you found the one."
About Joel, whom he's forgotten, broke my stupid heart. "But listen, Dad," I have to say. We met in college. I was standing outside the classroom building, waiting for my next class. I was eating a sandwich, turning slowly like a stand fan, trying to find the wind so it could blow the hair from my face and away from the sandwich. It was peanut butter and jelly, and there was the risk of my hair getting caught in the jelly.
"Are you lost?"
Joel had asked, justifiably. He invited me to a party that night. I said I'd think about it. In the end, I went only because I flipped this dime. Heads meant go, and tails meant stay. It had landed heads, so I went. But not before drinking a jelly jar of whiskey in my dorm room. That dime misled me. The next time I saw Joel after the breakup, it was by accident, a couple of months later. It was Sunday, and we were both at the market, on market. We both had in our hands clear bags of carrots. I was seeing a mechanic named Franklin who had a weakness for carrot cake and a 2-year-old son named Davy. This was week number 2 of Franklin. We'd last a month. There was a single tomato in a baggie in Joel's other hand.
"For a salad," he said.
And because we had nothing else to say to each other, I said, of all things, "I've heard some dogs enjoy the odd carrot."
"I didn't know that,"
he said. And then, to fill the silence, he said,
"Someone told me cats can't eat onions. They die if they do."
"You're Ruth," said a woman. "Pleased to meet you." Joel introduced her as Kristen. I said something that was supposed to be normal, but came out weird. Pleasure, maybe, or pleasure's all mine. I already knew about her. I knew about her car with its Oregon plates parked there outside Joel's in my old apartment, first thing in the morning. I didn't want to see it there, I told myself, but the truth was that I did want to see the car, or else why would I have felt that it was necessary to walk down that particular street, past that particular apartment that had been ours every chance I had, but especially in the mornings before work. It had to be that something inside me wanted to confirm that it would be there. It always was. Davy cried when I said goodbye, as though he knew the finality in it, and that was the hardest part about Franklin. What makes it okay, though, is that there's no way he remembers me now. You know what else is unfair about Joel? That I loosened the jar lid so somebody else could open him. February 23rd. "Up, up, up," says the woman in this exercise tape about our buttocks. As it turns out, Mom's old workout clothes fit me, so I have on her leggings and her tank top and same-size sports bra. And hot pink terry wristbands. I'd unearthed our VCR from the attic to watch them. Mom used these tapes to get back into shape after I was born, which makes me feel I don't know how. She was 25, in her prime childbearing years. I don't know how I got to be 30. I don't feel 30, the way I felt so definitely 9 and 13 and 21. This woman has us run in place. Then she has us do a series of impossible things with our arms. Now I clean the toilet faster, and flip the pancakes stronger. "Why are you shouting?" Mom asks. February 24th. The moon tonight looks like a cut zucchini coin. I'm filling up on gas at the cheaper station when somebody says,
"Ruth,"
at a different pump. My old friend Reggie is waving enthusiastically. He's immediately recognizable. He looks exactly the same. In high school, we were in a band together. I sang backup vocals and played the guitar.
We would practice in his parents' garage. We called ourselves Bambi Mama, and our hit song, meaning the song we played constantly, was The Best Things in Life. It went, "The best things in life, the best things in life are free. The best things in life are free toes." We had a good time. Inside the gas station, Reggie buys an Almond Joy for me and a cup of decaf for himself. And we sit together on the curb near the air and water pumps, each of us catching the other up. He'd moved away and moved back recently. First, he lived in New York, and then he lived in Miami. For a year and a half now, he's been teaching drama at our old high school. There is an animal in the parking lot with us. It looks like a stray dog, but something about it seems different, seems wrong. The creature doesn't have any of that modesty that dogs have. It doesn't seem tentative. It doesn't seem like it wants us to tell it what to do.
"Coyote," Reggie says. "They're getting bolder because of the drought. They're looking for water."
When Reggie says water, the thing comes right up to us as if summoned. It looks at Reggie first, and then it stares at me. Over us, the moon is emitting its yellow zucchini light. Reggie reaches into his pocket and pulls out something small and shiny. A whistle. He blows on it. It makes a shrill noise, and that's all it takes. The coyote runs away.
"It works on mountain lions, too," he says.
He offers his hand to help me up. I notice the new tattoos on his arms and a scar on his jaw that's unfamiliar. He walks me to my car. He says I can get a whistle of my own at the police department or at City Hall. "For free?" I ask.
"For free. Like the best things in life,"
Reggie says, grinning.
"Like free toes."
February 25th. At 3 in the morning, I find Dad in front of the TV watching Ron Popeil sell a Ronco Showtime rotisserie. Dad pushes the loaf of bread that he's sharing the couch with to the side and pats the seat beside him. I take it. We fix ourselves peanut butter sandwiches. He cuts his into rectangles. I go triangles. I remember I used to command him, "Make me a peanut butter and jelly sandwich." And my dad would say, "Poof, you're a peanut butter and jelly sandwich." We watch the rotating chickens, mesmerized.
"We could just set it and forget it,"
Dad repeats softly. "For a low, low price," I agree. "Just 4 easy installments."
"Fetch my credit card,"
Dad says, and we call the 1-800 number to order it. February 26th. I'm getting reused to these things. The trash trucks, the eucalyptus smell, the quiet and cold mornings during which, unlike in San Francisco, you hardly ever hear any sirens. On a walk this morning, I notice a lacquered chopstick in the gutter, its twin down the road. A waitress outside the diner with the $1.99 eggs and sausage shaking the ashes of her cigarette into a big gulp cup. A kid jumping over a line of traffic cones. A bunch of Great Danes being walked that move like horses. In the park, a woman says, "Sit," to her thin dog. The dog squats but never lets its rear end touch the ground. The woman says, "Sit," to her other dog, and it does the same. That's just how they were raised, I guess. "Why doesn't somebody get the mail?" Mom says, dramatically carrying in an armful of envelopes. February 27th. Grooms, over the phone, is telling me that she has been reading Kevin, Paradise Lost. Except that, being a baby, he hasn't seemed very interested. Finally, she put scotch tape on his forehead, and it was obvious that he preferred the tape. "Don't be too hard on him," I'm advising. "Remember, he's a baby." At the store, there are potatoes in a bin with this big sign above them that says, "Freshly dug." They're the size of feet. Above the avocados, it says, "Touch me, tender." A woman is stroking a portobello. "Wow," she says to me, a complete stranger. Would you look at the gills on that mushroom? It endears her to me completely. Also, while I'm staring at the oils, an alert employee informs me that canola oil is made from rape seeds. Do I need any help? At home, there are two boxes on the doorstep. Two boxes. One is full of loofahs, 12 colorful mesh poofs. Why? We don't know. Dad claims all the pinks. The other is our Ronco rotisserie that we've forgotten we bought. I drive back to the store to fetch a chicken. Back at home, we put it in the machine. We set it, but we don't forget it. We watch the chicken turn over and over and over. You should definitely buy one. I call Bonnie to tell, breathy with excitement. February 28th. Is this a thing? Lately, I'm more forgiving. I used to be very quick to judge the old men who don't know that when you walk past them on the sidewalk where they're sweeping leaves, they should stop sweeping. But now it occurs to me that maybe these old men have maladies, diseases that affect their manners, and should be pardoned. March 1st. I have a dream I'm King Midas, but instead of gold, it's aluminum. Everything I touch turns to it. I hug my father and, poof, he turns into a tin man.
I have a heart,
he says sorrowfully.
That's not the problem.
What's the problem? I ask, peering at him. He has rust-rimmed eyes.
I am always cold, he says.
March 2nd. We're moving class off campus starting this week because Levin's schedule has become erratic, and we no longer feel confident in our ability to avoid him. Theo has spotted him on campus every day this week. Rumor has it that he's having trouble at home, and that's why he's spending all this extra time on campus. The idea Theo and I plant into Dad's head is that because we're learning about the Los Angeles Aqueduct, we should take an educational field trip to go visit it. We should see it in person. The aqueduct was started in 1908. It would divert water from farms in Owens Valley, whose water was runoff from the Sierra Nevadas. The question was always, who should get the water, Owens Valley or Los Angeles? Teddy Roosevelt voted in favor of Los Angeles. The farmers were unhappy with that decision. You can still make out the parts of the aqueduct that the farmers dynamited. Dad is lecturing happily despite the sun, which is beating down on us. Nobody looks comfortable. Sweat is collecting between my boobs, and I want to scoop it out.
That looks heavy, Theo whispers about my purse.
It is, I whisper back. Wordlessly, he lifts it off my shoulder and puts it onto his. March 4th. I see, walking on the other side of the street today, a man with enormous pecs. They look as inflated as popcorn bags right after microwaving. The phrase, born humans, is what I think of whenever I see someone wildly different from me. Fetal circulation is different from that of born humans. Fetuses have fine hair all over them that born humans don't have. Fetuses do a thing like breathing that isn't actually breathing. The motions develop their lungs. They take their first breath when they're born, and that's when the whole system changes incredibly. Unborn to born. We're born humans, I think, about the huge pecked man. With our functioning circulatory systems, breathing, walking, having real hair. Just look at us. Later, at the farmer's market, I watch a couple bros sample dates.
Shit,
says one bro, coughing.
I think I'm allergic to this giant raisin. That's not a raisin, Steve, says another bro. That's a medjool date.
Born humans, I remind myself. March 5th.
We're at Home Depot because Dad's decided he wants to finish building the covering for the patio. He abandoned the project years ago when I was in high school. In a book called Backyard Structures, we find a photo of the thing he wants to build. A pergola, the book says, and provides a list of materials and steps like a recipe. We load a cart with fresh 2x4s and buy a new saw blade to replace his rusted one. Near the cash registers, an old woman is struggling to pull some orange buckets apart. Dad helps her. We tie red bandanas to the wood that juts from the car's open trunk and cross our fingers that the cops don't pull us over. My grandfather was a carpenter and a roofer.
"But I'm afraid of heights,"
is what Dad confesses to me now. March 6th.
Today you asked if I'd ever watched a moth eat clothes, and I replied honestly, no. Today you said you didn't believe it. Today you admired a magnolia tree, and I told you that it was one of the Earth's oldest plants, that the flowers are so big because beetles used to crawl into them carrying the pollen on their legs. And you asked, why should I believe you? And that was a very good question.
March 7th. Linus called, so I'm trying to chop a bell pepper one-handed and making slow progress. He's telling me about his latest argument with Rita, which was over what to have for dinner. I don't care, she said, when it was clear, he said, that she did. This week Rita got back from Bali, where she'd been for a month, doing yoga and drinking fruit juice. As of 3 days ago, she's back, looking fitter than she ever has, and now they are being awkward with each other. Linus worries that he has gained as much weight as she's lost. They are having trouble getting back into the swing of things.
You'd think we'd have so much to talk about, in terms of, like, ground to cover, stuff that happened while we were apart,
he says.
But when I ask her questions, it's like she's hesitating, deciding what to tell me, or she'll answer in a really bare-bones way.
It's not that easy to say what happened, I say. What happened to you, for example, yesterday?
I tried to talk to my girlfriend about her vacation. That's what happened.
There's a pause.
What if she met someone?
He says. You're overthinking this, I say. I try to sound convincing, reassuring.
Let's talk about something else,
he says. I tell him about what I read today. That scientists have learned how to embed false memories in mice. Using pulses of light, they were able to make the mice remember something that never happened, something unpleasant. The mice showed fear, remembering the thing that happened that had never actually happened. Memories are stored in collections of cells, and when we remember, we reassemble the cells like a puzzle. A few years ago, they figured out how to give mice déjà vu. They gave the mice the feeling of having been somewhere before. Last year, they figured out how to implant memories in a piece of brain in a test tube. Which, whatever, is my feeling. Why don't they figure out how to keep mice from forgetting things? We don't need more memories. It's hard enough trying to get a handle on the ones we've got. What do you think happens to all the mice? I ask Linus.
I hope they're retired somewhere,
Linus says. I hope someone is feeding them Gouda and giving them massages.
And they're fat. And they're happy.
Is that Linus?
Mom asks, peeking into the kitchen, and I nod.
Let me talk to him,
she says, taking my phone.
Hi, dear,
I hear her say. March 9th. Theo has sent me a photo of his parking permit, and I've been on the computer trying to counterfeit one for the car. The font isn't exactly right, but it's close enough, I figure. Not close enough to use in the actual parking lot, but realistic enough to appease Dad. I glue-stick the faux permit to the front windshield. Today we're in a lecture hall because Harry, one of Dad's students, tipped us off that his philosophy teacher, who typically teaches a class on Plato during our exact time slot, has been out with the flu. The space is comically large, big enough to accommodate 150 students. The eight of us settle into the first two rows. Today he's talking about the gold rush, which those of us who grew up in California already know something about from our fifth grade curriculums. The tens of thousands of men who came in hopes of striking it rich. We panned for planted gold at Knott's Berry Farm. In the books we read, men had to bathe in champagne because water was too expensive. And women sold pear blossoms to prospectors, tagging the trees with their names. One day they'd become pears or they wouldn't. Everything was a gamble back then. Everything maybe still is. Every day in San Francisco, on my commute home, I would pass the same elderly Asian woman standing on a street corner, holding a napkin to her face and giggling behind it, playing peekaboo with nobody. Once, a man talking to a mail slot turned to me and told me he was an angel. All I had on me was a $5 bill, which I gave to him. A long time ago, I stopped wondering why there were so many crazy people. What surprises me now is that there are so many sane ones. After class, Theo and I convene at his apartment to do what teaching assistants are supposed to do. What we've told Dad is that we're entering essay grades into the computer system. But actually, we're eating delivery pad Thai and reading the notes Dad's written on students' papers. The notes are critical but thoughtful. The papers are long and well-researched and earnest. I'm choking up a little bit at this whole unbelievable situation.
How was your bedside manner working at the hospital?
Theo asks. Unobtrusive, I say, like a lamp. After I tell him about the loofahs, he shakes his head.
Sometimes it's just the way of the universe, he says. Once I got a 10-pound box of sour belts.
Did you send it back?
Not going to dignify that with a response,
he says. Now he's squinting at his fortune. Are you, I ask, farsighted? Immediately he looks sheepish. I read it out loud for him. You will grow slightly fatter every year. He fishes his glasses from his backpack. Joel had better vision than I did, and so he was the one who, in the mornings when we woke up, could tell me the time. Sometimes I think he could see things coming, but I couldn't. The last ultrasound I gave was to a woman named Lucille. She was 5 months pregnant with a boy. I said something only marginally funny, and she peed all over the examination table. That they're called pregnancy symptoms has always struck me as strange. Symptoms, I mean. I remember the start of a yoga class, the instructor asking if anybody had any injuries, and a pregnant woman raising her hand. Well, you know, she shrugged. Same thing with patient. At the hospital the other day, the doctor, referring to Dad, called him the Alzheimer's patient. Patient for what? I wanted to ask.
Earth to Ruth, Theo says. You okay?
Later, at home, my phone rings, and it's Grooms, who, instead of saying hello, is weeping into the phone. Kevin said, blah. The most chill first word. March 10th. Dad's in the backyard cutting up wood and cursing. I'm walking to the library to return the DVD when a small child on a scooter shrieks at me.
A woman!
In case, I guess, I'd forgotten. Lately, my thing is inventing new yoga poses. The onion is one. You make yourself very round, then peel yourself limb by limb. March 11th. Tonight I try my hand at dessert. Baked Alaska. Because of course! It's so epic. How can you bake Alaska? How can you not? March 12th. I'm losing it too. I intended to return a book to the library, but dropped it by mistake into a mailbox. At the library where I've gone to explain myself, I run into Regina, who was homecoming queen our junior year. She had hay-colored hair to her waist, and I envied it. She has children now, They share names with hurricanes. I don't know if it's intentional or what.
This is Katrina, and this is Sandy,
she introduces. The children are 4 and 8, and even so young, their expressions look overcast. March 13th. Okay, and then today, I drop stamp mail into a trash can. Online, I read that the youngest person to have ever been diagnosed with Alzheimer's was aged 30. March 14th. I'm spending the weekend with Bonnie. Bonnie and I are at the drive-thru. Someday we'll make more money, Bonnie is certain. I'm less. For now, we're buying hamburgers because cheese is 99 cents more. Bonnie has slices stowed away in a pocket in her purse that we insert into our burgers. After, at an estate sale inside a tackle box, we find a compartment with teeth in it. Filled and gold-capped teeth and bits of pried-out gold fillings. We buy them. We have a job to do tonight. We're seat-filling for the Oscars, there to make the ceremony look full. Bonnie talked her boss into letting me work, too. We're sharing the same tube of Chanel. The color is pirate. I'm wearing lone diamonds, and Brad Pitt is 2 rows away. In the bathroom, we discuss things I could do for an actual living. I could get a job nannying. Parents I did ultrasounds for would sometimes bring me their born babies. Let me hold them. No, Bonnie remarks without missing a beat. Repeat what you just said to yourself. Afterward, we're paid in cash, and we decide to spend it at Jared's sushi restaurant. The restaurant is called Tomorrow. It's in a strip mall in Tahunga, and we have to step over a dead cat in the parking lot. We order omakase. Seeing us, Jared claps his hands together. He carves me a rose from a radish. Let's see that eel peeling, I say, and he turns suddenly shy. It's fine. The sushi is fine. Because there's no alcohol at home, I haven't had a drink in weeks. I put too much sake into my body, by mistake. Back at Bonnie's place, I say to Bonnie, let me cut your hair, just to try. This is terrible, she says once I'm through, staring into her reflection. That's my professional opinion. March 16th. The sun is out and it feels like spring, so we propose having class outside, which Dad thinks is a great idea. He suggests the lawn outside the library. We suggest Mission San Gabriel for the historical element. It's not chronological, Dad protests. We're past the 1700s. But we have our way, and the class divides into carpools. We spend the sunny day in the grass, all of us in sunglasses, in view of the tombstones. On the way home, Theo, Dad, and I, in Theo's Subaru, stop by an In-N-Out. Theo orders a hamburger rather than a cheeseburger. I hold the burger hostage instead of immediately handing it over and interrogate. Why a hamburger? Because it's cheaper? It's not that, he says. It's just, I don't know if it's worth it. I don't think I can taste the cheese. March 18th. Mom and Dad are watching a recording of this year's Oscars to see if Bonnie and I are visible. All the actresses in ball gowns tell us what they're wearing. I'm wearing Dior Haute Couture. I'm wearing 100 small emeralds. I just had a cheeseburger. I'm starving. And Dad pokes fun at the actors and actresses, remembers all their names like any regular, not sick person. It's Mom who finds us. She pushes pause and points her finger to the screen, and there we are, though out of focus. Bonnie and me in our borrowed dresses and jewels and 2 bright lipstick, looking not like ourselves. Brad Pitt! Mom exclaims, thrilled. Look how close you are! March 20th. because I've read that sulforaphane produced in the body and found in broccoli can help keep the brain sharp, I cook broccoli for lunch and broccoli for dinner. The vegetables are called cruciferous because their flowers are cross-shaped, I also read. Sometimes I switch it up with cauliflower. I cook small, oily fish for their omega-3s. For breakfast, we have oatmeal with flax seeds, which also have omega-3s, and berries, which have antioxidants. A diet can't reverse harm that's already done, I know. But what if it could halt the decline? March 21st. I'm looking for stamps. If I send in these empty coffee bags, I'll get a $5 manufacturer's rebate. $5 buys me another bag of beans. The goal is to keep this up forever and never buy coffee again. My stamp search is turning up empty. What I find in the junk drawer instead are divorce papers with signatures from both my parents, dated the year before last, meaning well after the physicist was purportedly out of the picture. I remember my parents used to let me have their old checkbooks, and the fake checks I used to write to Linus, to my parents, worth billions. Void, I would write on the memo line. Maybe, I thought, this had been somebody's idea of an imaginative game. Divorce papers, all filled out. I can't be in this house because of everything. Plus, the kitchen sink is spitting food up and there's a wasp's nest the size of a head outside underneath the awning. I head to the laundromat with our hampers. It's a reassuring thought that the machines work there. Outside the laundromat, two drunks are sharing a cigarette. He has a hand tenderly cradling the back of her head, which she appears to enjoy at first, before she begins to resent it.
"You think it's lumpy," she says,
pulling away suddenly.
"You think my head is lumpy."
"I don't think it's lumpy,"
he says.
"You do,"
she says.
"You think it's lumpy."
"Baby, I love your head,"
he says.
"You're saying I'm not smart,"
she says.
"Is that what you're incinerating?"
He says,
"I'm not incinerating a thing."
"It's nothing," my mother says when I ask about the papers. We're watching a show on TV. Families are having their homes redecorated by TV show people who insist the families throw out all their belongings with sentimental value and replace them with brand new items. The people always protest when their things are thrown out. "Mom," I say.
"Shh,"
she says, while a video game console gets appraised.
"No way in hell,"
says the owner of the video game console, unwilling to let it go. There was a time, I'm now remembering, she let Linus cry until my dad finally came home and changed his dirty diaper. What could that have meant? That was before everything went wrong, though. Wasn't it? March 22nd. Now, I'm just looking in every drawer like it's my job. Cleaning the guest room, I find in a drawer written in my mother's hand on the back of an unopened envelope. "Howard, leaving empty bottles in the car's center console, crashing into a shrub in front of the house, peeling open a bunch of bananas, one by one, and abandoning them naked on the table. Saying to me, here's a thought, I do not deserve you." And below, "Howard, drunk. Howard causing me sadness. Howard, Howard, Howard." In the glove compartment of his car, I find expired packets of mustard. They were once my dad's, I know, to fool my mother and the breathalyzer. Also in the glove compartment, a photo from the first family vacation I can remember. A trip to Washington, D.C. On the subway, coming back from the Lincoln Memorial, Linus and I were in a pair of seats, and my mom and dad in seats opposite each other. Leaving the memorial, they'd just gotten into an argument. Who knows what the subject was? On the train, my dad had patted the seat next to him, a way to beckon her over. She shook her head slowly and seriously and tried to keep a stern face. It had taken a moment before she smiled. Later, in the house, I find a photo of us at the actual memorial, Linus is bright pink, like he's been crying, and my parents are scowling, and I'm eyeing the man with the cart full of ice cream in the corner. Let's not talk about this now, okay? Mom says. She rubs lotion into her hands and then opens the newspaper. For better grip, she says from behind it. You can ask me anything, dear, she adds. Just later. I wonder if this is why my mother asked me to stay. She didn't want to be alone with him.
Don't blame anyone else,
was what William Mulholland said, we learned, when the St. Francis Dam failed.
You just fasten it on me. If there was an error in human judgment, I was the human.
Fasten a failure. Like a pin on a necktie. March 23rd. Class this week is off campus. Because it's raining and there's a leak, Theo tells Dad. We're crowded around a small table at a cafe. A cupping is happening. They've given us little cups of beans that we are to smell. Joan, a graduate student, maybe my age, always sits near Dad. She has far-apart eyes and long blonde hair. Actually, none of her hair isn't impressive. Her eyelashes curve in this logic-defying way as if each set of lashes might be able to support a mothball or a marble. She bears a resemblance to Kristen, Joel's new girlfriend. They look like they might own the same breed of dog or buy the same type of groceries. Immediately, I don't like her. I notice Joan trying to catch his eye, my dad not picking up on it. That's when I realize, oh, and try not to follow that thought any further. Why her? I'd ask Joel about Kristen. I don't know why I thought he'd give me an answer. Outside, there are undergraduates putting tags on trees. When I ask what's going on, one of the girls says, we're tracking squirrels. That's the moment Theo appears beside me.
Squirrel teeth, I recently learned, he says, grow continuously. It's something like 6 inches every year. But eating all those nuts and things keeps their teeth from ever getting that long.
I don't believe you, I say. Dad and Joan are talking. They aren't touching, but for some reason, beneath the doorway, they look like two people who've slept together.
Believe me or don't, it's true,
Theo is saying. So if we trapped a squirrel and tied its hands and feet behind its back,
And fed it,
a strict no-nut diet,
or a liquid nut diet.
Liquid nut?
Like almond milk or peanut butter.
A liquid nut diet of almond milk and peanut butter,
we could grow a saber-toothed squirrel.
Theo nods. I try not to make it obvious that I'm watching Joan, who is talking with my father, who is shaking his head.
How cool would that be?
What? I say.
The squirrel, he says.
Very, I agree. I watch Howard put a hand on Joan's shoulder to say goodbye.
You're not as into this as I am,
he says. The squirrel? I say. He nods. It sounds dangerous, I say. That's all. I look over, and Joan is gone, and my father is alone. And when he sees me, he taps his watch. March 24th. Okay, but listen. This is why I so seldom visited. I didn't want Linus's claims confirmed. I wanted to preserve my memory of my perfect father. I didn't want to know the many ways he'd hurt my mother. I didn't want to have to pick sides. Unlike my brother, I wouldn't have been able to do it as easily. A couple of years ago, Dad visited me in San Francisco. He was in town for an academic conference and staying at a hotel downtown. We had an early dinner with Joel, but Joel was on call, so he left Dad and me to drink together. At first, it was exciting. I had never seen him drink to excess. I had never gotten drunk with my dad before. It felt like a way to be closer. But then it became apparent we weren't drinking together. He was drinking like it was a race, and I drank and drank to keep up. I don't know how many drinks in we were when he confessed to having had an affair with the physics professor, the one that Linus had told me about and that I had hoped to myself wasn't true. It was years ago, he continued, and it had been a mistake. He loved my mother. He felt that he was still being punished even though it had happened so long ago. He didn't know how to make things right, but he would. He had to. Did he bring up divorce then? Try as hard as I can to remember. I can't. I don't remember making the decision to go to bed. I woke up on the hotel couch, jeans still on, a blanket pulled over me. On the floor was an empty bottle of whiskey, drained, and another bottle of wine I don't remember. Dad left for the airport early, and I could smell whiskey on him when we hugged goodbye. It was clear he didn't remember much of the night. He didn't seem ashamed about it. I was still a little drunk. Everything smelled like alcohol and was repulsive. The smell might have been coming from inside my nose. I could smell it in the waistband of my jeans, so I took them off and chucked them across the room. I picked up a glass of water that was sitting on the nightstand, took a swig, and spat it out. It was gin or vodka or some combination of the two. I tidied the hotel room in my underwear, throwing the bottles away, straightening things. I drew myself a bath. What happened? Joel said when he picked me up. My hair was still wet from the bath. My face was pink. I burst into tears hideously. I hiccuped the whole drive home. March 26th. Mom's been heading straight to the living room after work. Today, she takes a bag of popcorn and a plate of the broccoli I've made for dinner.
Good,
she nods, and turns on the TV. I join her. The star of the show is a bachelor who is to select his future wife from a group of women. He is an ex-soccer star. He calls all the women girls.
There are so many beautiful girls to choose from, he says. How is it possible I can ever be able to make this choice?
During commercial breaks, it's Mom changing the subject, Mom balancing popcorn on my knee, Mom not letting me in on things and me having trouble eliciting it from her. And Dad, without a clue, eating his dinner, screwing pieces of wood to other pieces of wood, cautiously climbing a ladder, oblivious to any atmospheric disturbance. I walk to the nearest bus stop and board the bus. I get on without looking to see which bus it is. Not that I know what any of the numbers mean. A couple is sitting on the bus. The young woman is feeding her boyfriend yogurt. A mouth, if you aren't interested in the person it belongs to, is disgusting. The couple gets off the bus, and a large man in a police uniform gets on. I wonder what happened to his car. Hey, stranger, somebody else says to him. His face snaps out of his dull bus-riding face.
Hey,
he says.
Hey.
How many kids you got now? She asks.
5,
he says. Before I know it, we're at the last stop. I don't know what city we're in. There are warehouses all around me, a vast, unending parking lot. I try Reggie, my only friend still in town, but he doesn't pick up. I dial Philip, and Theo answers after the first ring. This is embarrassing, I say. But could you give me a ride home?
Where are you?
He says. I'm sorry, I say, and read him the cross streets. He picks me up after not too long and doesn't ask what happened, which I appreciate. Instead, he tells me about his day. How he was when I called, leaving a bad stand-up show and feeling outrage. How earlier today he returned bad avocados to the grocery store and got a refund and felt triumphant. We've been in the car for an hour. He pulls into my driveway. Can we, I don't know, sit here for a second? I ask.
Sure,
he says, still not asking any questions, and which I still appreciate. What happened with them? I finally ask Theo. Theo, who knows Dad, who knows Joan. He inhales, holds his breath for a second.
It's really none of my business,
he says.
There was a flirtation between them. Text messages, I think it started last semester, lasted a couple months. She said he led her on. He didn't seem to think so.